Our next speaker is Vinita Dutta, well known to many of us in this room. She's a professor of French Studies at Wellesley College. Her most recent book, Heroes and Legends of Fin de Siècle France, Gender Politics and National Identity, came out in 2011. More recently, she's been working on co-editing a special issue of French Historical Studies in honor of Rachel Fuchs, which is due out in 2018. And for those of you who don't know, there's going to be a special session tomorrow, right? Tomorrow afternoon in Rachel's memory. She is also, an article of hers is coming out also next year in French Historical Studies, Buffalo Bill Goes to France, French-American Encounters, 1889 and 1905. And she's also been working with our third speaker today, Dominique Khalifa, on a piece entitled The Gilded Age in his Dénommé l'histoire, Essai sur les noms du temps, 19e siècle au 20e siècle, which is also forthcoming in 2018. Her title today is Crimes Against the Nation, The Theft of the Mona Lisa in 1911.
It was working a second ago. Is the Patrick, can you see if the projector is on?
It's supposed to be on.
Okay. Maybe you have to log in again or something. Ah, there it is, there it is.
What happened?
I don't know. It's okay. But sinon je continue son.
I can call Keith since I have his number.
I mean, can obviously do the paper without the images, but they are kind of fun. Mm-hmm. All right, so should I just go ahead, or should we wait?
You want to?
I it would be nice to see it here, and then just to advance, just press that one. Okay. No, I think
we
we're good.
The lights, or yeah, I think it's okay.
Don't dim them too much because I can't see otherwise. Hey. All right, I think I can start now. On the quiet Monday morning of August 21st, 1911, Vincenzo Perugia, an Italian glazier and painter who had worked at the Louvre, walked into the museum and snatched Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa off the wall. Claiming that it had been looted from Italy by Napoleonic troops and that his crime had been patriotic, Perugia hid the painting in his small Parisian apartment for 2 years before attempting to restore it to its country of origin in 1913. Despite following numerous leads, the French police were unable to locate the painting and discover the identity of the thief. The mysterious disappearance of the Mona Lisa highlighted both the lax security of the Louvre and the rivalry between the Préfecture de Paris and the Sûreté Nationale, which impeded the investigation. And indeed, Perugia had left fingerprints on the glass of the frame and had the authorities compared those prints to a copy of his prints, Perugia had a prior record, in Alphonse Bertillon's famous anthropometry file, the thief would have been caught immediately. The theft of the Mona Lisa was not only a sensational crime, capturing the public imagination, both in France and abroad, but it also led to the painting's emergence as a French national icon. While the Mona Lisa had been considered one of the great treasures of the Louvre, its theft elicited an outpouring of public attention, inspiring songs, cutout dolls, caricatures, and calendars. And I'm going to try to show you a couple of those. Those are the songs from the BHVP. There were about 300 in the file. And we've got a cutout doll, cutout here. And a calendar. At any rate, henceforth, the face of the Mona Lisa was known to even ordinary Parisians, especially to readers of the press. Indeed, the press followed the case very closely, with journalists sometimes inserting themselves in the investigation. L'Illustration offered 10,000 francs for information leading to the return of the painting and 40,000 francs to the person bringing back the painting to the Illustration offices. While the police believed the theft to be the work of an international art ring, some members of the public were convinced that an American collector had commissioned the heist. Yeah, it died. Okay. All right. Had commissioned the heist, while still others believe the theft to be the work of a mentally disturbed man enamored of the painting. Critics of the regime, both on the left and the right, predictably used the occasion of the theft to attack the corrupt bureaucracy of the government and or to lament the moral laxity of the age. In short, the theft became a national cause célèbre and a symbol of wider social, political, and cultural concerns of a nation on the brink of war. While novelists and journalists have amply covered the history of the painting's disappearance, magic, see? Historians have devoted little attention to the theft, one of the last big faits divers of World War I. That is really distracting. Maybe I should just close it up for right now. I have a couple slides at the end I can show you, but let's just do that because you're all going to get blinding headaches, and I don't want it to be because of my paper. In short, the theft became a national cause célèbre and a symbol of a wider social, political, and cultural concerns. And while novelists have covered the history of the painting's disappearance, historians have devoted little attention to the theft. And the exception is Aaron Frenchow, who in a recent article illustrates how Parisians seeking to make sense of the theft created narratives of the crime, weaving them into their daily lives and their own personal stories about life in Paris. And while the role of crime stories is important to my work on the Mona Lisa, I plan to focus on the political, social, and cultural repercussions of the theft, in particular the process by which the painting assumed its iconic status. Studying the theft of the Mona Lisa and its triumphant return from Italy in January 1914 gives us a snapshot of France on the eve of the First World War. The theft took place in August 1911, 3 years before the beginning of World War I, and it ended with Perugia's trial in Italy in June 1914, barely 2 months before the guns of August. The concerns of the impending war in the preceding years obviously played a role in the way in which contemporaries viewed the theft. In 1904, the French and the British had signed the Entente Cordiale, which was tested and strengthened the following year by the first Moroccan crisis, the Coup de Tanger, and again in July 1911 after the Germans sent a gunboat to the Moroccan port of Agadir in response to the deployment of French troops in April. While the crisis ended peacefully, the incident clearly illustrated the fragility of peace among the European nations and signaled the inevitability of war. By 1911, the United States too loomed, not only as an increasingly stronger economic power, but also an imperial one, especially in the wake of the Spanish-American War. And moreover, its cultural presence was much more visible in France than previously through the Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show, the World's Fair, and the Barnum and Bailey Circus. The tensions of the Dreyfus Affair and the division of church and state had only barely been papered over by the nationalist revival that took place after 1905, and they dovetailed with the social unrest of the period, the strikes of 1906 to 1909, and with anxieties about criminality in France, especially in Paris. Robert Nye has spoken of this period as one marked by la grande peur de la bourgeoisie, which reached an apogee from 1906 to 1909 and was rooted in discussions about a law that proposed to abolish the death penalty. But the period also witnessed an upsurge in actual crime and a fear of crime, especially in Paris, exemplified not only by the sensational spy trial of Benjamin Ulmot, but also famous murder trials of the era, those of Meg Steinhell, Henriette Caillot, and Albert Soleil-Land. This period also witnessed the exploits of the so-called apaches, criminal gangs like the anarchist-influenced Bonneau gang, which terrorized Paris and its surroundings in 1911 to 1912. Heightened anxieties about crime are reflected in the popularity of crime fiction, from Gaston Leroux novels to tales about Fantômas and Zigomar, among others, about which both Dominique and Robin have written, as well as films of the period. Added to this mix was a sensationalist press that blurred the line between fact and fiction, but which also helped to forge what Benedict Anderson has dubbed imagined communities, a nation of disparate individuals brought together as a community of newspaper readers. Indeed, the newspapers contributed to the emergence of the Mona Lisa as a national icon. The theft of the Mona Lisa led to countless reproductions of her image, and you saw a number of them, both in the regular and satirical press. Various newspapers not only reproduced the painting on their front pages, but they also offered limited edition copies printed on fine paper for their discerning readers. Caricatures of the Mona Lisa and songs written in her honor sold briskly. Cabarets even depicted scenes of the theft of the painting. In some sense, the Mona Lisa became a stand-in for Marianne, and indeed for the women of the country. One author, signing himself Le Vieux Médecin, feared that the theft of the painting would exacerbate depopulation. And I will tell you how. Through the modern press, the image of the Mona Lisa, whom he described as the type of woman inclined to dystopia and prone to a difficult or impossible labor, was disseminated everywhere, in cottages as well as in chateaux. Le Vieux Médecin feared that contemplating the Mona Lisa would have deleterious effects on pregnant women, since he claimed that pregnant women were marked by images of what they had seen during pregnancy. Not only would these women potentially miscarry, but children they did bear would have the same facial traits as those of the celebrated painting. Now, think about that for a while. He concluded his article by asking for the immediate return of the portrait. While the doctor's analysis seems overblown, to say the least, it does reflect, his discourse does reflect the fear of depopulation at this time. Between 1871 and 1911, the French population grew by only 8.6%, as compared with 60% for Germany and 54% for Britain. To some extent, this fear was manifested by a crisis of masculinity in which French men were defensive about their masculinity and hostile both to non-normative sexuality, which they defined as sexual deviance, as well as toward new women and feminists who challenged traditional gender roles. While the first doctor was concerned about pregnant women viewing the painting, another doctor, Georges Dumas, a professor of experimental psychology at the Sorbonne, perhaps reacting to investigating Magistrate Drieu's confirmation that the authorities had received numerous love letters addressed to the painting, described the potential thief as a sexual deviant. In a letter published in Le Temps, he stated that the thief could well be a mentally deranged man with sadistic and fetishistic tendencies who would take pleasure in mutilating, biting or stinging, the word in French is piquer, and sullying the Mona Lisa. The theft and potential mutilation of the painting reflected both a fear and fascination about crimes of passion. In most cases, however, those committing crimes of passion were women, so perhaps the fact that a man might have been responsible for such a crime would inspire uneasiness about his masculinity. Just as important is the fact that these words, which signal sexual violence, are metaphors for rape. Already, the loss of the Franco-Prussian War, which had been viewed in such terms, as well as an amputation of the body politic. In some sense, the declarations of these two medical men are the reverse sides of the same coin, the fear of damage inflicted on the nation through the endangerment of its women. Both men's concerns reflect contemporary fears of depopulation, especially in light of an impending war, although neither mentions the issue specifically. While other press articles are not as explicit as these two, a good number, especially the satirical pieces and songs, imagine the Mona Lisa frequenting the Grand Boulevard, riding the omnibus, and even traveling by train or steamship. Many of these excursions would have been in the purview of bourgeois women of the time, and these comic sketches and songs constituted a tongue-in-cheek commentary on the freedom with which women moved in the urban space of the city. Nevertheless, as the same commentators noted, there were places where respectable women could not go. Some professed their fear that the Mona Lisa had frequented insalubrious parts of the capital and or other cities and had visited cabarets. Others feared that the mass-produced Mona Lisa was no longer an object of consumption for connoisseurs. Upon the painting's return, one reporter, writing for Le Journal, declared that the Mona Lisa was now sullied by the gaze and touch of the popular classes and had thus lost her allure. She had been profaned after having been dragged across popular stages, sung about at every street corner, and whose caricature had been pasted on every wall of the city. His fear was surely a comment on mass democratic society in which art was no longer the purview of a selected elite. And indeed, numerous discussions of the time revolved around whether the museum should require entrance fees in order to offset the costs of the security of the works. Many in the press, especially those on the left, however, held to the Republican ideal that the Louvre Museum was part of the national patrimony and should be free and open to all citizens. Aaron Frensha has suggested that the space of the Louvre became a site of danger, as symbolized by urban crime, and thus both fascinated newspaper readers and inspired fear. And I'd like to take that idea and push it a bit further and suggest that the discussions about the security of the Louvre, the repository of national treasures, was in some way a displacement of concerns about national security. And that's not to say that the security of the Louvre was not important. Nevertheless, this idea of the security of the Louvre was a metonym for the safety of the nation. Contemporaries, even those sympathetic to the regime, demanded to know how and why security was so lax that a major painting could be taken off the wall without anyone noticing the theft or the thief. In wake of the theft, reforms were undertaken to make sure that the administration of the museum was no longer in the hands of scholars who were not qualified to protect the nation's treasures. Attacks on the regime came from the left as well as the right. Urbain Goyer, who can best be described as an anti-Semitic Dreyfusard, exhorted the French to become more public-spirited, an expression he quoted in English. He lamented the fact that the French were too individualist to work together toward the common good, unlike the Americans and the British, to the point that when they saw crimes being committed, they looked the other way, claiming it wasn't their responsibility. Such a lack of civic duty, he warned, would lead to the rise of Caesarism. Predictably, those in the nationalist press used the theft to denounce the very existence of the Republican regime. The nationalist Le Gaulois, which wrote on occasion of the return of the painting on December 26, 1913, declared that the theft was more than just a question of the theft of the painting itself, but rather a symbol of the anarchy of the current regime, a lack of discipline, weakness of character, and a general lack of energy. The invective in L'Action Française was, of course, openly anti-Semitic, with the paper attributing both the loss of the painting to Jews in the Republican government as well as to Jewish thieves. For Charles Maurras and his associates, the Louvre, like France's national libraries, was an integral part of French national identity and indeed of national patrimony. Moreover, given their idea of a French-Latin identity associated with the monarchy, the theft of an Italian treasure painted by an artist patronized by a French king was especially troubling. Léon Daudet accused the investigating magistrate and the police of not following up clues for fear of finding another Dreyfus or Ulmo. Most tellingly, he specifically made the link between various groups he and other conservatives found dangerous: Jews, Apaches, and criminals, and finally, Americans. In the heart of Paris, there prospers in the pay of American and Jewish collectors a black band composed in part by Jewish hiders and receivers of stolen goods and supported by Apaches and international thieves recruited for major heists. As for Charles Maurras, he concluded, as long as there are Americans to buy paintings, there will be Jews to steal them. The linking of anti-Americanism and anti-Semitism is significant. Together, these elements constitute and anti-France, opposed to the Mohassian idea of a Latin identity. And moreover, both groups were linked to technology, business, and in short, modernity. In Au Signe de Fleurs, Maurras writes about coming to Paris at age 20, and this would have been in 1888, and already noticing the urban ugliness and standardization of the city. For him and other members of the Action Française, the increased Americanization of the country was yet one more symbol of its decadence. Rumors circulated in the press about the thieves who had either stolen the painting at the behest of an American collector or were trying to sell it to a rich American, and J.P. Morgan's name comes up several times. So this American collector would then supposedly hoard his prize in secret since the painting could never be sold on the open market. Le Petit Parisien asks in a headline of August 31st, 1911, is the Mona Lisa in New York? As well as, does Germany really know anything? As this latter headline illustrates, the fear of Americans was accompanied by a fear of all foreigners in France, a concern not limited to those on the extreme right. In the new age of steamships and trains, there was greater circulation of people and goods. Many of the false leads associated with the theft of the Mona Lisa have to do with seeing shadowy foreign figures supposedly boarding steamships and bound for the United States, or for trains departing for Germany and Spain. A number of these false leads culminated in the arrest of foreigners in the country, among them German students and Spanish workers. The Affaire Apollinaire was yet another indication of the fear of foreigners and a misunderstanding of avant-garde artists. The writer was implicated in the theft of the Mona Lisa when his former secretary, a Belgian national named Guéry Pierret, went to the offices of the Paris Journal with a statuette he had stolen earlier to illustrate just how easy it was to steal from the Louvre. When Apollinaire, who realized that Pierret had sold him two of the stolen statuettes, returned them to the newspaper for the promise of anonymity, he was arrested along with Picasso. While Picasso was released immediately, Apollinaire was jailed for an entire week and predictably the subject of the right-wing paper's ire, some of whom mistakenly thought he was Jewish, although Léon Daudet defended Apollinaire in the pages of the Action Française, declaring that the thief, the real one, must be a Jew in any case. Paris Journal published a protestation signed by a group of artists and writers in Apollinaire's favor, among them former Dreyfusard Octave Mirbeau, who derided the commercial smile of the Mona Lisa and simultaneously defended the rights of writers and artists of the avant-garde against official justice and mass culture, calling to mind the defense of Oscar Wilde several years earlier in 1895. And now we come to the thief himself, Vincenzo Perugia. And I do have his mugshot, but I'm afraid if I try to do this, can we try to see if we can get that image here? All right, it's maybe I can show it at the end. Perugia hailed from Dumenza, Italy. By 1911, Italians far outpaced Belgians as the first immigrant group in France, representing 36% of the total immigrant population, or 1% of the entire population. Of course, the French only learned of the identity of the thief in December 1913, when Perugia tried to return the painting to a Florentine art dealer for a fee, claiming he had committed a patriotic crime. The pretense of a patriotic crime was unmasked early on once the police discovered in Perugia's possession a notebook listing names of dealers who might wish to buy the painting. But the patriotic defense served Perugia well in Italy. He got 15 months for the crime, and he wasn't able to be extradited to France. While some of the French newspapers predictably sniped against the presence of Italian workers who sought to steal the livelihood of their French counterparts, most of the French did not react to the identity of the perpetrator with hostility toward Italy. In fact, the cooperation of the Italian authorities with French officials was an occasion to celebrate Franco-Italian friendship. The grateful French authorities offered to let the Italians display the painting in Florence, Rome, and Milan before returning it to France with great ceremony. After being exhibited at the École des Beaux-Arts, the painting went home to the Louvre on January 4, 1914, where, according to Le Matin, 100,000 visitors came to see the painting. The theft of the Mona Lisa, as contemporaries recognize, was about much more than the theft itself. The mysterious disappearance of the painting, which became a stand-in for the figure of Marianne, touched on contemporary anxieties about national identity. In the years before the war, national security concerns were of great importance. And in some ways, the focus on national security was displaced to a debate about the security of the Louvre, which, as we've seen, was a repository of the country's national treasures. These national security concerns, which included contemporary fears about crime, depopulation, the presence of foreigners, especially Americans, the role of women in French society, and indeed modernity itself, were channeled into a national fixation on the Mona Lisa. Hundreds of thousands of readers followed the details of the theft closely, and as the archives tell us, tried to engage directly in helping to solve the crime, more often than not, flooding investigators with false clues. Edward Berenson has suggested in his work on the Madame Caillot murder trial that the French were more focused on the faits divers than on events leading up to the war in the summer of 1914. Perhaps this was the case because they had already rehearsed their fears about the impending war through their creation of an imagined community during the theft of the Mona Lisa. The return of the painting to France in January 1914 represented the restoration of an order that would forever be destroyed just a few short months later. Thank you.